Welcome to Syracuse Speaks. Central New Yorkers face an election in about a week with dozens of offices on the ballot for positions that will decide things like tax rates, education policy, and district lines. But voter turnout in elections for primarily local races has been historically low. In light of this, community groups and political researchers alike are asking what will get people engaged. I'm WAER reporter and host Katie Zolkowski, here today with news director Chris Bolt.
And in this hour, Syracuse Speaks will take a closer look at the current state of voting in Onondaga County and research that shows that voting traditions might not fit with current work and social norms.
With us today, we have Chanel Turnquest with the organization Onondaga Votes, a group working to increase voter turnout in local elections. Welcome.
Thank you.
We have Shayna Kushner-Guderian, Syracuse University political science professor specializing in American politics, political communication, and political psychology. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Tom Buckle, Onondaga County District 7 legislator elected in 2017. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
So the first question I want to get to ask you all is, what is some of the patterns and perceptions of voting in Onondaga County? So who's voting? Who's not voting? Why is our voter turnout so low?
Well, I guess I'll start. I've been working with Onondaga Vote passionately, helping to encourage people to get out to vote, to register. And what our group has been doing is I'm trying to get polls and information from the people who are voting and connecting to their neighbors and hoping that they'll join us to encourage their neighbors to vote. And some of the comments we've heard from some of the people are that, we don't know who the politicians are. They only come out when it's election time, or they don't feel like their voice is being heard. They don't understand that their voice does matter on a local level, not just when it's time for the presidential election, because our local politicians are the ones who make the choices for us locally in terms of as menial as snow removal. People don't understand how much their vote impacts and how their community doesn't get serviced as much as other communities where people are going out to vote. So we try to communicate with citizens of the city and the area, in the small area that we're working in, to let them know it does matter and try to explain to them how, not voting is actually voting. You're voting not to get your needs, certain needs met. Your silence is voting. And if you don't vote, things won't get better.
That's right.
So I think it's worth just, this is Professor Guderian, thinking about what are the things that lead people to vote. And so we know from the research, it's about people who have more time, who have more money and more resources in terms of knowledge, are more likely to feel comfortable participating. And so when we have communities that either don't have the time, because until recently, our election days were on a Tuesday.
Right.
Polls weren't open all day. In terms of knowledge, right, local media, if it doesn't cover what's going on in local politics, people don't know who their representatives are. They don't know what the offices stand for, and they don't know the differences across candidates. So time, money, and people who have more money also often have more time to devote to getting the knowledge that allows them the ability to participate. So those are the kinds of things that we know drive people to participate. Also efficacy, like Chanel was talking about, feeling like your voice is important, feeling like when you participate, someone listens, and that something actually happens. Those are the things that drive people to participate. So if we have lower levels of those things in certain communities, they're less likely to want to participate. I'll just mention one more thing, which is the number of offices that we have and the timing of our elections makes it very hard to keep up for most people unless you're extraordinarily politically engaged. The fact that we have elections in odd years means that people who are paying attention to national politics are off this year, right? They're not, you know, they're, so they might not be as engaged. So I think structurally it makes it really hard for people to participate. I think some of these new changes that we'll talk about, like early voting, makes it easier for some people. But I think those structural things, like having it in 2019 rather than 2020, makes a huge difference.
I mean, you talked a little bit about some of these reforms, and early voting is going into play this year for the first time. How will that affect things? And are there reforms, like you were saying, structural changes that need to go further?
I think early voting helps a great deal. I think that it allows for people who, again, who don't have a lot of flexibility with their jobs to be able to go on a Saturday or go not necessarily to a particular location that's in their neighborhood. I think that helps a lot, and that was one of the things the state legislature changed to make it easier. I think our registration date is a bit later this year. It used to, right? So we also make people register ahead of time before they can vote. We could allow people to register day of rather than many weeks ahead of time. That would make it a lot easier for people to vote. Those are the kinds of things. And I think well, this is probably going to get me kicked out of political science departments, but I also think we have too many offices. I think we vote for too many offices, and that we have too many layers of government, and it makes it hard for people to keep up.
That might be a topic for another show about layers of government, a conversation that's gone on in this community for years. Tom, in running campaigns most recently, but also in past campaigns, do you get a sense of why people vote and why people don't vote?
I think the same sense I got from experience is what we just heard about the structural impediments and the demographics. But I think it's important to say, you know, the premise that started this conversation was that local turnouts are really low. Well, in this nation and in our community and state, our democratic participation is lower compared to other democratic nations
sure.
as a whole. And yes, it's true that turnout does decrease in local elections. But I do think some of the structural factors we talked about will make a difference. But there's also, there's more than just the structural factors. 2 years ago in the local election, turnout spiked. And one of the reasons it spiked is that there was a hot button issue before the people. It was, you know, whether or not it was widely understood and presented fairly, it was the Constitutional Convention to have a referendum to have a Constitutional Convention to talk about revising the state constitution.
Yes.
So there was a lot of controversy about that. And it drove turnout, which tells me, as important as structural factors and demographic factors are, there are times that interest drives people, even in local elections.
Mm-hmm. And do you think that maybe that's something that needs to be communicated better? Is there should there be better communication about what's at stake for local elections?
Oh, most definitely. I think if people understood how much is at risk and what they're voting for, I think they would come out more. But it's just being, how do you inform everyone of what's going on, and how do they not get bombarded by the propaganda that sometimes goes along with that, you know, because our campaigns can sometimes become very, they don't focus on the issues at hand. It might be more personal, and, you know, it becomes, the issues get convoluted. Mm-hmm. It's like what's important, and it's people fighting, bickering, and spending money on that as opposed to, hey, we need to make a change. We need to focus on what really matters and how it what's going to impact us.
So I think that I would just pick up where Tom was talking about particular issues, right? So we know, again, from the research about what drives people out to vote, it's also about two emotions drive people to vote, anger and enthusiasm, right? And so to the extent that people get angry about issues, right, we might not find that the most comfortable, but actually anger will drive people to participate. And that actually is a, if we want to think about fuller democracy, more participation means fuller democracy. Enthusiasm also gets people to participate. If you think about like the Mayor Walsh, one of the things that got him over the bar of having not being in a particular party is the enthusiasm that people had for his candidacy.
Sure.
And so I think having issues that people care about and either kind of exogenous issues like 81, it has to get fixed, right? And the state says it has to get fixed. Or these more locally grown issues, like whether or not there's going to be a constitutional convention. Those are ones that I think can get people engaged, and the engagement gets them out to vote.
You know, Chanel, the irony of what you said about the the negative campaigning is that while it's not always uniform, but on the local level, the tendency is the nastiness is somewhat muted. Not always.
Right, that is true.
You know, when you go to church with somebody, some of the nastiness you might hear on the national level doesn't filter down, or when you're in the community. And it's not to say it doesn't exist.
Right,
it does.
Right.
We see a little bit of that in this election. But those are sometimes that can be a very positive thing. But ironically, the lower turnout elections tend to have less of the real bitter, nasty fights that go on in other contexts.
I can agree with that in some areas. That mayoral election was a little touch and go.
So we've been talking about why people don't vote in local elections and what impact local elections have on the community. Coming up, we'll discuss how changing societal norms could be affecting voter turnout and why young people are the least likely group to vote in non-presidential years. Stay with us.
Usually I'm not a big candidate meter. I don't like to get out. I wait till voting day and meet them. But today was a good day to do it. And I wanted to get out. And I got frustrated, you know, with people just saying, oh, you know, these candidates are going to do this. Let me get out there and meet them, you know, and let them know how I feel. And that's what I did.
This month on Her Hilltop High, we take a look at first-year student traditions, the first basketball game played at Syracuse University, and the establishment of the iconic Syracuse Block S. Listen to Her Hilltop High, a look at Syracuse University's history ahead of its 150th anniversary, only on WAER.org.
I think people should have stands at the mall. A lot of people go to the mall. Little public places around here, a lot of businesses should have voter registrations within them. So people that don't get out or can't go out far, they're able to come within their community and be like, oh, I can sign up right here instead of going downtown to sign up or get on public assistance to sign up.
Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks. We've been talking about local elections and what's keeping us from increasing voter turnout. Next, we'll take a look at how voting traditions and practices may be affecting that turnout. With us here today, we have Chanel Turnquest with Onondaga Votes, Syracuse University political science professor Shayna Gadarian, and Onondaga County District 7 legislator Tom Buckle. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Thanks.
So when researching local election low voter turnout, the Knight Foundation found that only 1 in 5 millennials vote. Their research found this was for a number of reasons. They believe that there's a lack of trustworthy information about local candidates. They move a lot more than previous generations, and they don't have the same social patterns or communication methods. So is it time for traditions around voting to be reevaluated or even changed?
I'd say, being a parent of millennials, I'm constantly fighting to get them engaged. Their view is, although they know about voting and, you know, they know they have to vote, but they themselves and some of their peers say that, you know, it doesn't seem like their voice is being heard. You know, they're not seeing the fruits of you know, their peers. I'm like, hey, tell your friends. They just seem not interested. I don't know if it's the technology or, you know, they're focusing on other things, but they're not focusing on how they're going to be impacted by getting elected. I don't know if it's immediate gratification. You know, there's so many other issues. I guess, you would be better versed.
I think some of the structural things that you talked about, Katie, that there's millennials, right? And we should also be clear that, like, millennials are people who are now in their 30s,
right?
So there are, and millennials are in their 20s and 30s. We have this kind of Gen Z, which is people who are now coming of age to vote. But the kinds of things that the fact that we require registration and that you have to re-register every place that you live, and if you move around a lot, that's a barrier, right? So again, same day registration might make it easier for people who move around a lot. And the fact that millennials have started their careers in a job market that is very uneven. Many of them are doing work that is where they don't have traditional workplaces. Workplaces are a place where you pick up political information and where you can make connections. And we know also connections and social connections are really important for people to convince other friends to come out and vote, right? And that those social connections in traditional social institutions like churches and workplaces and civic organizations. These are ways in which people make connections that get them connected to also voting. And these are different for people, young people today. And so I do think we want to think about ways in which we could, if not recreate those kinds of social connections, at least reach people where they are. And again, making it easier to vote, pushing out good information through social media, not misinformation, I think, is a really big part of it. But also just communicating the importance of, I'm always getting my students, giving them the message about how important their voices are, because they have fundamentally different interests and different views than people who are my age and older. And without those views in democracy, elected officials don't know and don't care what they say unless people turn up and vote, unless they call, unless they're showing up on election day.
I have two reactions, and that is, we want voter participation, I think, generally to increase at any age, any status of life. There's no question about that. And we focus on young people who do historically vote in lower numbers than other generations. In this nation, some data suggests that in 2018, there's been population and voting shifts. In 2018, as a whole, the numbers of millennials and Gen Zs, the newer youth generation, collectively are outvoting the older generations. Not necessarily percentage-wise, but in raw numbers. So the power is beginning to vest in the younger generations.
But do you think that that's a result of 2018 being a congressional year as well as on the opposite side of local elections?
I think it's, yes, there's an interest standpoint, but there's also, we're just talking about the law of large numbers. There's a shift in this nation, a demographic shift taking place to the 40 and under generation of voters. My generations, the so-called baby boomer, we will continue to vote in larger percentages of our total, but the raw numbers are suggesting a shift. And as Shana indicated, there are clear economic differences between the generations in terms of jobs, property, wealth, the ability to run and manage businesses, to be enterprising, and with it, as Chanel noted, there's also some continuing and unjust distinctions in how wealth and income is distributed. But I think that there's numbers and power now to see a shift in that as we go forward.
I like to say, though, some of the issues that we see coming in the forefront in terms of student loans is impacting some of the young people wanting to get involved. Jobs, I know that's a big thing. I have a 27-year-old and a 25-year-old. And, you know, when they were younger, we were heavily involved in civic organizations. And now they're like, I need a job. I want to work. I need, you know, I have student loans to pay. So that has actually had an impact, you know. And again, are they, oh, let's go and vote, let's go rally? They're more like, I got to go get a job. Mom, yeah. I'm with you. But I, you know, so again, those issues, as those issues become more prominent, you know, development, and then when you talk about locally, you know, jobs in the community. My son actually is an arborist. He went to ESF. And he's working in New York City. And I'm like, we're in the country. We're in Syracuse. You know, there should be plenty of opportunities for him right here. You know? And so, you know, again, these issues do have an impact on young people. And I'm like, you're registered here. I'm going to, you know, he's been moving around. He worked with Davies Trees. You know, so, you know, just job wise, it's kind of like I'm reminding him to vote. So.
Well, the irony there is that that's an issue, again, I mean, a local political structure has more impact on what happens locally for job creation. I mean, an economic development strategy, what does or doesn't get approved, you know, which is very, you know, very routine retail politics. And, you know, that is the kind of thing you'd think they'd get involved with. I mean, candidates and parties do get people involved in voting when you come to an election. Does that need to change now because people aren't in the typical areas or aren't communicating in certain ways? Have you changed how, you know, you've connected with voters in recent days because of social media or just where people are, Tom?
Yes. I did use social media, but there's still no substitute for person-to-person contact. That's, I think, the data suggests, and my own experience suggests, that that's still the most powerful force in politics. Structurally, and I'm talking from the boots on the ground, the political party aspect of it, until the resources and the focus is on expanding the voter base and putting resources into trying to grab an expanded voter pool, at least on the local level, it's going to continue year after year, cycle after cycle, because we're only going after, with our limited money, those that we know have voted in the past.
Shane, anything to add about what needs to be done to increase engagement?
I mean, those are all the answers I would have given, right, which is grassroots organizing, parties. If we wanted to expand, the parties have to have an incentive to expand, right? So it's the parties who would benefit from those voters who are not already there who need to spend the money and spend the time and the volunteers in reaching out to communities. But I think that's from the party aspect, from the aspect of, you know, democracy, right? More people voting means a fuller democracy, and it means more reflection of everyone's voice. So I think that's worth doing, even if it doesn't benefit the parties. But that was going to require groups like Chanel's, who are nonpartisan, to reach out to more voters.
I even heard recently, at a meeting I was further downstate, like with even voter early voting, they're even looking to put, because money is limited, even where they're assigning the locations for early voting, they're looking to go to the neighborhoods where people are voting. And some of those people, you know, they vote. And the other people who don't vote, you know, probably need it more because they're working the two and three jobs.
Yeah, gotcha.
So it's just, it's amazing how it's almost cyclical.
Right, and which was what Tom was saying, it's sort of self-perpetuating.
Yeah. Well, Shana said they need an incentive. The incentive is to win.
Sure.
Especially if you're constantly in the minority of the legislatures or losing, there's a big incentive. On the other hand, organizing at the neighborhood level is so important to bring the two forces together.
So can you tell those people at the county legislature, come join us?
Well, they do. They really do. For
the nonpartisan, because everyone goes, knocks on doors, you know, again, when they're running. And that's the biggest thing you hear. But when you have people coming, just, hey, come out, tell your neighbors, you know, it has more of an, you know, so I don't know.
One of the really good things about local politics, and my colleagues on both parties are really generally really good about this. They go to the neighborhood meetings. They attend. They listen. They engage. Now, some people miss it, but I think in general, the town, city, and county representatives are pretty good about getting out and listening.
All right. Well, Tom Buckle, Shane Agdarian, Chanel Turnquist, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been talking about the nature of local elections, the problem of low voter turnout, and what some are trying to do to get people more engaged in the process. Coming up, the top office on the ballot this November is for Onondaga County Executive. We'll hear the visions for the county from two people trying to get elected to that office for the first time, even though one's the incumbent, coming up on Syracuse Speaks.
The power in voting, it uplifts our spirits. It gives us the courage to continue to go forward, you know, to bring on good leaders that's going to help strengthen us in numbers.
At WAER, trust is at the center of what we do. You trust that we'll take the time to diligently research the facts in order to deliver the most balanced and comprehensive coverage possible. You trust that we won't ignore or overlook issues because they're difficult. And in return, we trust that when the time comes to help support the future of WAER, that we'll hear from you. Why wait? You can do your part now by visiting WAER.org and clicking the red donate button at the top of the page.
Voting is important because it voices your opinion. That's how you can speak for what you stand for. And if you vote and find the right person to vote for, you're able to help your community out within yourself also. Local elections are very important, especially when they're in your community. They focus on what's important in your community, like the violence rate. Our streets need to be fixed, the houses, you know, like bringing more business within the community, because if you vote locally within your community, you'll get more from your community.
Thanks for listening to Syracuse Speaks on 88.3 FM WAER. I'm Katie Zolkowski. Tony Malavenda has spent the majority of his life as a business owner, working across the country on sewer infrastructure. Now he's sold his business and is running as the Democratic candidate for Onondaga County Executive. He's pledged a significant amount of his own money to his campaign. And Malavenda has run for office once before in Central New York, in 1983. He was 27, running against the Republican majority leader in the Onondaga County Legislature and lost. He has a number of priorities for this campaign, including modernizing our digital infrastructure and creating economic opportunity for all. But when I sat down with Malavenda in the middle of October, he really emphasized the need for a culture adjustment within county government.
County government is very, the government itself, the structure, that there's a cultural problem. I think we have a problem, a political culture, with our political culture in particular, where county government is extremely old-fashioned. It's like what you would see if you were watching an old black-and-white TV show or a movie about politics, right? Mm-hmm. We have a very old-style government that I don't believe is the type of government that can really lead us into the future. You know, it's a government that is based essentially on this three-legged stool of incredibly gerrymandered legislative districts, a pay-to-play system in which incumbents receive donations from county vendors, from anyone looking to curry favor, whether it's they're actually contracting with the county, or they're looking for a job, or they're looking for a permit, or the ability to, you know, developer issue. And then the last thing is cronyism and nepotism, where county jobs are used, you know, for political purposes. And, you know, that kind of a government is in and of itself what it creates, whether the people are well-intentioned or not, but it creates the same people being empowered forever. You just don't have a marketplace of ideas. It leads to stagnation. And I don't think anybody can argue that Onondaga County has stagnated for decades.
Would that be one of the ways that you would make county government work better for people in Onondaga County?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think what we have to do is we have to, first you have to recognize it. You know, you have to be committed to it. It has to be part of your value structure. It's been a big part of my campaign. You know, it's public knowledge that I have contributed a significant amount to this campaign. If I didn't do that, I couldn't be competitive. So my competitor in this announced publicly that he would raise and spend $1 million in this campaign. So how many people, especially younger people, right, after you have a family and a mortgage or college loans to pay off, who can go out and raise that kind of money? You can't. It's impossible. And that's a problem. So we absolutely have to have campaign finance reform. Because I'm taking no money from anyone who works for the county, right? Not from the firms, and to the best as much as I can police it, not from executives or executive spouses, because all those games are played too. And I can tell you that if I win, I think there's a good chance that we're going to move some Democratic legislators in too. Hmm. And they've been on the losing end of gerrymandering forever. And there's a big commitment. You can see it across the board. All the Democratic ledge candidates are talking, going door to door with the legislative map that shows you just how wildly gerrymandered that it is, right?
So campaign finance, redistricting, those are priorities for you going into this campaign.
They are. They're priorities for me. What I'd like to do is set the county up for real positive growth and change, structural change, not just being beholden whenever the governor comes to town and he gives us some jobs, that's great. But if we're really going to seize this point where we are in our history, we need to modernize our government. You know, right now we are in the century of the Internet of Things, which 100 years ago in 1919, it was the century of electricity, right? Mm-hmm. To me, our IT systems are as important as our pipes and our highways. They are an infrastructure upon which everything happens, where all decisions are made. And in county government right now, we live in it's like a data desert. I think they're improving. They're getting better. I think they've got the department is certainly committed there. I've talked to people there. But it's not just the county. It's all those other partners that we talked about earlier, these other governments. Mm-hmm. I would like to get everybody on the same platform so that we can share data and, you know, do the sorts of things that other municipalities, frankly, have already been doing, mm-hmm. right? And not only would that protect us, would we be better protected? Would it be easier for us to defend ourselves from cybercrime? But also, you know, there's no reason that, I don't know, let's say you wanted to open a car wash, right? You should be able to go online and see where every car wash is in the county, where every commercial piece of land is vacant that is zoned for a car wash, to help you decide where you want to locate, where you want to invest. That data is out there somewhere, but we can't get at it. The county website is opaque. It's hard to get minutes. I mean, look at other counties. Go to some of the more progressive municipalities around the country and just pull up their county websites and compare the two. Mm-hmm. It's shocking.
As far as infrastructure is concerned, there's a lot that is on the table. I mean, from sewer and water lines, mm-hmm. and even big, very public projects like the I-81
yes.
project.
Mm-hmm.
What is your view for the advancement of those?
Yeah. So first of all, infrastructure is what I did. That was my business. I've spent my whole adult life in infrastructure, improving sewer systems around the country. So infrastructure is clearly important, and important to me because it's my language, and I'm in some ways maybe I'm almost biased towards it. But 81 is the most significant infrastructure project since 81, since it was mm-hmm. built. And when it was built, I was a little boy. I was like literally in diapers when they started working on that, mm-hmm. right? Cooperation means full-throated support for the mayor and for the grid. Being able to say this, not just in the city, but saying that in Salina, where I know it's not popular, right? Or in Skaney Atlas, where they have issues, where they're worried about trucks, right? If we can agree on that, if we had gotten past that, especially a year ago, frankly, right, then the discussion should be resting on a unified voice promoting how we do it best and addressing those hotels. And how do we create a hotel pod through signage and through Google? When you Google, you need a hotel and you're coming down 81. That will send you to that 7 North exit, right? To some of those hotels that we have over there. How do we address the construction process and people that might need to be displaced? How are we going to do that for the people that literally live along that where 81's got to come down? How do we get those people to the table? They should be participating in those discussions. You know, they're the ones that have to live through it. And we, you know, and I just don't see that happening. We need to talk about 481 handling the traffic. If eventually we get an inland port, 481 is going to be picking up even more truck traffic. Issues that have come up in the context of 81 are already issues. And if we were all on the same page and saying, okay, we're going with this grid because you know what? There isn't a significant city in this country that has an elevated highway dividing its economic core.
You mentioned a little while back about how the city is seeing some growth and there has been some progress in the county. With growth, sometimes, especially in tech, comes unequal growth. So how, as the city and the county take on technology as something that they want to invest in, make sure that it is inclusive and that it's not just going to the same people who had already been benefiting from it in the first place?
Right. That's a great question, actually. I want to go back to the first premise that we are seeing growth downtown. But the truth is, we're not really seeing much outside of downtown. Now, as far as making sure that there's actual equity in the development of our economy here, we've obviously done a horrific job, right? And it's not for want of trying. I mean, we have so many programs. We've thrown a lot of money at poverty over the decades, but we are number one in the country in concentrated minority poverty, right? And we're something like 20, depending on who you study. You know, we're not doing well overall. So, I mean, it's not just an inner city problem. Our levels of working poor, people who still need assistance, public assistance, even though they have work, those populations in the city, it's something like 62% of city residents. But in East Syracuse, it's 60. In many of our communities, it's in the 50s or 40s. Even in Fayetteville, it's like 20, like one in five people require assistance. So, you know, we have a real issue with poverty. And, you know, I think one of the things is getting the people who live in it to the table. The people that you're talking about have been frozen out of that government forever. So I don't see that changing unless we really change the government. And I would also say that we need much more investment in workforce training. We need more investment, you know, in addressing the poverty issues that actually reflect back on economic development. So even if you ignore the sort of social justice issues, and I'm not saying that you should, right? Obviously, they're there. But just from a business development point of view, if you're a company, if you're not tied to this area emotionally, like I was and my partner was because mm-hmm. we were born here, you can offer a tax break to get somebody here and they're going to take it. I would take it. I did take them. But companies come here because it fits like logistical issues, right? But also, where do their employees want to be? Who's going to be their employees? So if they start Googling Syracuse and they see number one in concentrated minority poverty and they don't have a reason to come here, they don't want to come to this town. I believe all this stuff is really in many ways is interconnected.
Just following that, what would you say to people who have been historically left out of the conversation, especially surrounding government and democracy and the whole process of building a city? The civics could feel exclusionary.
We have to start bringing people to the table. But it isn't just, like I said, the inner city. We have a lot of farmers. When I go out, we have farmers that they're on dial-up. You know, they don't have broadband, right? We're talking about bringing 5G to the city. We need to bring broadband. I went and visited this one farm. Their name was Bloomer. You know, they have 300 head. It's fairly, that's not a big dairy farm, but it's 300 head. Even in a farm like that size, you know, to milk cows, you need the internet these days. We have to realize that we're all in this together, that we will grow better if we work together. And everybody has something valuable to say, but there are a lot of these people that have been left out of the conversation, right? And the only way to bring them in is to build the structures to bring them in, not just to have a promise from me or any other politician.
So if the election doesn't go in your favor, how do you plan to stay involved in the county, making sure that you are still trying to push through these initiatives that you have so thought out and poured so much energy into?
Well, I'm not really allowing myself to assume, to accept the proposition that I won't win. But of course, you never know. Look, I'm 63. I just built a house in the city. I think I had the last lot in the city. And, you know, so obviously I'm staying here. It is my plan to stay here. If I don't get elected, if I'm here, I will say that for me, I would say don't feel sorry for me because I have met so many great people. I thought I knew the community in the county. I've been involved in community organizations since I was in my 40s, non-for-profits, but the breadth and scope of organizations and people who are really committed to being here is just been incredibly energizing for me to see and to learn. I know so many more people now. I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm going to remain committed. I started walking with the OGs, right? You know, and I'm going to keep going with that. Had I not run for office, I probably never would have done it. You know, I'm ashamed to say I wouldn't have done it. I wouldn't have known, right? But now that I know, I'm engaged. Mm-hmm. And that's just like one example. So,
well, Tony Malavenda, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Tony Malavenda, the Democratic candidate running for Onondaga County Executive. Coming up, WAER's Chris Bolt sits down with Malavenda's opponent and current county executive, Ryan McMahon. This is Syracuse Speaks. Stay with us.
WAER strives to elevate the conversation about news.
The transportation system, I can speak for New York State, is very safe and in pretty darn good shape.
Music.
I think her makes R&B fun for a newer generation.
And local theater.
I didn't really know that there was a musical until around 2015 when Liam was like, oh, wouldn't she be great in The Addams Family, the musical? And I was like, the what?
We hope you'll join us at 88.3 FM or online at WAER.org.
Thanks for listening to Syracuse Speaks on 88.3 FM WAER. I'm Chris Bolt. Ryan McMahon has been a pretty visible top executive for Onondaga County over the past 9 months. He took over the job when Joni Mahoney resigned. Coming from the post of county legislature chair, he was no stranger to the county's business and its challenges. He's been out front on a renewed battle to go after tax-delinquent properties, has often talked about how Syracuse poverty drags down the region, and has some pretty strong ideas about economic development and fixing up the area's infrastructure. This will be the first countywide election in which he's running. I asked McMahon, after his on-the-job training, if you will, what he sees as the role of county executive.
Yeah, so the county executive's role is to manage the day-to-day operations of the county, at the same time propose legislation to the legislative branch of government at times, as well as to really drive an agenda for the region. And we develop the vision and the planning through our various departments, really implementing various short, mid, and long-term goals.
Certainly part of the region, big part of the region you can't escape is the city of Syracuse.
Mm-hmm.
How important is it to have good relationship and collaboration with the mayor of the city of Syracuse, who's in a similar role?
It's critical. When you look at the fact that the downtown, the urban core, is our economic driver for the region, every city resident is my constituent, as well as every town, village residents as well. So the two leaders need to work together, and our teams work day in and day out together. They need to work well together if you're going to really make significant progress. That's what's been happening here in the county and the city over the last year. And right now, I challenge anyone to point out a time where the mayor and the county executive have collaborated the way that Mayor Walsh and I have. And right now, we have a point in time where we have an alignment with leadership. At the same time, we have aligned intentions, when that happens, you see tremendous results, and that's what we're seeing.
So you're coming off essentially an interim role, kind of a on-the-job training as county executive,
mm-hmm.
obviously after being in the legislature. now that you can look at it as a four-year term ahead of you, what's your vision for the four-year term? What do you want to do?
Yeah, so we're going to continue to build on the progress that we've started with our PIE platform, focused in on poverty, infrastructure, and economic development, and our plans in these areas for short, mid, and long-term strategic goals. We believe in the next 4 years, as we address some of our infrastructure issues, we'll be able to really do a countywide plan. It's very naive to think you can do a plan when you don't know what your wastewater capacity is. We want to continue to work to implement the Syracuse Surge Strategy with the City of Syracuse, and also create connectivity from our downtowns to our south side, to our lakefront, continue to build on the momentum that we've built around Onondaga Lake, continue to work with our village and town partners to revitalize their communities, their small little downtowns, with our town partners to really build out town hamlets and really look at town centers to really help develop those communities. And at the same time, continue the fiscal record of excellence that we've had. We've cut the county tax rate 8 straight years, and we have one of the highest credit ratings that we have in any county in New York State.
What areas are really kind of making progress? We hear a lot of attention about how Syracuse is, you know, making strides, and certainly there are critics to that, but I think the general feeling is that Syracuse is definitely on the upswing in many ways. Countywide, what would you say are sort of two or three key areas of progress that's being made?
Yeah, well, I think the two areas, the Onondaga Lake efforts, and certainly the efforts that we've seen in downtown Syracuse are two easy ones to highlight. When you look at what's happened on the west side of the lake, you look at the Loop the Lake Trail, you look at the New York State Empire Trail that's now going to work through going into the Creek Walk. You look at some of the new development happening at the harbor with Bankers Health Group and building a $40 million building there and hiring 332 white-collar jobs. When you look at the fact that the Village of Liverpool is starting to see a resurgence in activity with our Village Main Street program, and you look at what's happening in the town of Clay with a state-of-the-art distribution and warehouse facility like one that this country has never seen, second biggest in the world potentially here, so over 1,000 jobs. So I think clearly, we're seeing an economic resurgence throughout the county with our downtown, and also with what's going on in the lake. It's helping to drive a recreational resurgence as well. But I think some of the harder stuff that we're seeing progress, it's been slow and deliberate and measured progress in poverty with our data. Lowest data we just got out from the census from 2018. The lowest rate of poverty we've had in our community in 10 years, so that's good. We think with the focus we've put in on it and our partners have put in on it and the new collaboration we have across our county, that number is going to continue to go down in 19. Progress being made on human health issues like lead paint, working together to get into these old houses, get it fixed, get this poison out of there. There's lots of small victories that are happening day in and day out. But certainly when you want to look at the big visuals, the partnerships that have been built in this community over the last 12 months are real, they're solid, and it's creating confidence and it's creating momentum for so many others to invest into our community.
Conversely, I mean, you did touch on some areas that are still remaining challenges, and as you said, with something like poverty, progress is incremental. It's not that the challenge isn't there. That being said, what are some of the things that really are going to be challenges in the next 4 years?
Yeah, infrastructure challenges will be here. Our wastewater infrastructure, right now we have a plan that our legislature is starting to look at with us taking over the ownership of the actual pipes, the physical infrastructure that towns and villages and the city own. We don't own them. These pipes are failing, and when they fail, it creates clean water in our wastewater system. We're treating and treating and treating more than we should at our wastewater treatment facilities. This costs money. And in really bad events, you may have an issue where you have an overflow. So none of these are good. The pipes also fail, and they fail. That means neighborhoods have sewer backups, not good. So we've put out a consolidation effort for us to fix the pipes, not build out larger wastewater treatment facilities to treat all this new water coming in. If we fix the pipes, this new water won't come in, and that will allow us to really understand the capacity we have in our wastewater systems, which allows us to have a plan to go attract certain types of economic industry Poverty and Human Services is going to be a challenge for the next 4 years. We're focused in on our six areas with health, housing, education, transportation as a barrier to work, workforce development strategies, and all the growing economic clusters that we have today, and really early childhood, kindergarten readiness. This is something where we're putting our stamp on. We're sounding the alarm bell that we need to do better as a community, and we put our money where our mouth is in our budget, putting $1.5 million in the Early Childhood Alliance.
We hear a lot of talk about inclusive economy, and some of the things that we have in front of us have the opportunities to, either through training or transportation barriers perhaps, with creative planning, reach an inclusive economy perhaps. Is it achievable with existing systems of inequality and tech innovations and stuff that sometimes leave people behind?
We believe it is, and we believe that that's why you need a diversified economy, and you need that different jobs require different levels of skill sets. And once you have those, then you have the workforce laboratory that can produce the individuals for those jobs. That's what we really envision with our countywide STEAM school initiative with the city and the county. In addition to that, workforce training programs that directly we have partners that specifically will train to the job, whether it's healthcare, whether it's low-tech manufacturing, whether it's logistics, whether it's construction trades. So these efforts are ongoing, with the 81 project out there being an opportunity to potentially have city residents, county residents working on these jobs. In addition to that, our minority women business procurement policies have always given opportunities to minority and women-owned businesses. Tech hasn't always been the most inclusive space, right? In the city, in the county, in Lemoyne, the Allen Foundation Center State CEO and SU put out for an Advancing Cities grant earlier this year. And what this grant represented was an independent validation of the partnership we have here. The other communities that won were Chicago, Miami, Louisville, San Diego. Think about that in Syracuse. And the goal of this grant is to create that that tech ecosystem with minority-owned tech companies, women-owned tech companies, veteran-owned tech companies. And so that when we're seeing a young pioneers here in the tech space at Digital Hive, at Ephesus, at SpinCar, at Plows and Mows, TCG, all these great young tech companies, that we're creating more and more young tech and trying to diversify that. So that's being done intentionally, and that's what we talk about, the alignment of leadership and the aligned intentions. And we need to be intentional to create workforce opportunities for people if we're serious about getting folks out of poverty.
You mentioned a couple times that there's businesses that are willing to try to bridge that gap with untrained workers. It seems like that's such a critical thing in our reporting on poverty and our City Limits Project. It came up time and again,
yep,
about how there's just not always the easy path, especially if business doesn't go along.
Yep.
Not to pick on anybody, but a high-tech or aerospace company has 50 jobs, 100 jobs available, but they have so many requirements. They're just not jobs that are a bridge job.
Right.
What's the role of leadership from this office to convince or show those companies or those companies' leaders that that's a value to not just, you know, the person who gets that job who otherwise might not have had a pathway to it, but to them and the whole community?
Yeah, look, at by talking, by reengaging with the employers the way we have, you know what their workforce challenges are. So then we team them up with the right workforce partner. That could be OCC. That could be WorkTrain. That could be MACNE. And then we are, in many cases, these employees will pay for apprenticeship type programs, the employers. But again, that's why you touched on it. That's why you need an economy that's diversified, because you're right. A defense aerospace company doesn't have time to train someone from the ground up with certain skill sets are needed. So that candidate's better suited for a logistics opportunity or a low-tech manufacturing opportunity. And so that's where this goes. And that's why with this diversified economy, this individual can have a pathway out of poverty into a job that will pay them a fair wage with benefits, but then they got time to build their skill sets and build towards that next step in that next company. And right now, you look at the economic data, 3.5% unemployment rate, the private sector job creation over 7,000 over the last year. It's double what Albany and Rochester's metro markets have been doing. We have these jobs available now. and the opportunities in front of us, we can really, really push the needle moving forward.
The city of Syracuse has made a lot of noise about having data-driven initiatives, Office of Innovation, et cetera, to make government more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
As county executive, are there ways that you can follow kind of that policy direction? Anything specific that you've seen happen in the city with kind of data-driven initiatives that could work at the county level?
Yeah, we already do it. We don't have a fancy office with a fancy name, the iLab, but we have an analytics team, specifically when it comes to human services. Yes, specifically when it comes to human services. We're the government in charge of human services at the local level. So we're tracking who are we serving, who are our clients, what touches do they have within all our various departments, whether it's social services, Department of Children and Family, and how can we better serve them to make sure that they have the services they need? And then with our Jobs Plus team, what's the plan to get them off of the services and into a career path? Certainly when you come to IT and cybersecurity, this is an area we're all going to be working together on moving forward. Governments are under attack because we carry insurance policies. It's a better business model for the hacker to go after someone with insurance than some little old lady who doesn't know how to access Bitcoin or cryptocurrency once they get hacked, right? So we're doing that. But data is critical when we're talking about our wastewater infrastructure. We utilize data. When certainly our sheriffs are utilizing data when they're looking at public safety. Our probation, we're utilizing data. When you look at our human services, we're utilizing data. Economic development, community development, we're always analyzing data. So our analytics team is there. I should probably get them a nice fancy office so that people know we're doing that.
Maybe finally, let me just ask, why is Onondaga County important to you?
This is home, and this is where my family and my ancestors called home. And if you look at my family's service to this community with the McMahon Ryan Child Advocacy Site, then some of us stepped into public life. It's always been about service and about believing that our community can do better, and we have the resources here to have an excellent quality of life. And we have four seasons, and we have water, and we have entertainment infrastructure, and we have great colleges and universities. We have great employers, but we can still do more. And that's what drives me every day. There's nothing more rewarding than helping people to me and carrying on the legacy of my relatives before me that have served our community in different ways.
All right, Ryan McMahon, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Syracuse Speaks, the importance of local elections. We've been discussing the changes in election rules and how to increase local turnout and participation.
And we want to say thank you to our panelists, Chanel Turnquist with the organization Onondaga Votes, Tom Buckle, a current county legislator who is not running for re-election, and Shana Kushner-Garderian, Syracuse University political science professor. Also, don't forget to listen for WAER election coverage during All Things Considered and Morning Edition right up until Election Day, including our election night coverage starting Tuesday at 9 p.m.
If you want to hear this program again or share it with someone else, you can go to our website, waer.org. There, you'll also find other Syracuse Speaks content. With WAER News Director Chris Bolt, I'm Katie Zolkowski. Thanks for listening.